Fuse Box. This is Fuse Box number 252, Pole Parrot. And you should do as I say, but not as I do.
That's right. Just march this way. That's right. Right this way. We're getting it ready for you. Keep right on going. The promised land is straight ahead.
See? All good things come to those that wait. Hello, friends. And welcome in to this, the 252nd edition of Fusebox, repetitively entitled Pole Parrot. And I'm your nabbering nabob of nonchalance host, Mark Rose, and over there, sitting contently in the green and amber glow of the out-of-control room is the maestro of mixology himself, Milt Keynes, everybody.
Well, thank you kindly. So, how was the trip, bro? Did you see any moose? Or interview any walrus?
No. No. No walrus on this trip, sadly.
Still freezing, though, right?
Well, I gotta say, for June, it was quite cool, at least for me. You know, not for the locals. Folks were telling me that having snow around in mid-June is pretty out of character, though. And by the way, highs for that period of time were in the low 50s. And the wind kind of sort of took it down even more. Friends, we're talking about a recent trip I took to Nome, Alaska, for a client I have up there. It's a radio station by the name of KNOM that has some of the most delightful folks I've ever had the pleasure of working with up there. And they hired me to do some audio branding for them.
Oh, yeah, IDs and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, IDs, music beds, show intros, special material. But I gotta say, the fun part of this project for me was creating the music and or beds using sounds that are sourced from nature and the native music and dance.
From nature?
Yeah, like trees become drums. Snow becomes whooshes, water becomes all sorts of things. Well like this. Milt, go ahead and punch up number 46, if you would.
Alrighty. Oh, that's very cool, bro. Now, was that a real chant? Or what?
Yeah, that front part was taken from a real piece of voice and drum music from the station's rather extensive archive of native music. And the beats were formed or resynthesized using, as I say, trees, you know, like knocking on limbs and so forth.
Yeah, it's got a really cool vibe, bro.
Yeah. And it's great fun to produce. So we're having a good time with all that. Sounds great on their air as well, and it's an incredible place. I mean, flying in, it's just this stunning range of mountains and tundra and great open spaces. Oh, and musk ox.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, these guys were all over the place. Sedate. Until you get into their faces, evidently. They've been known to attack people at times.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently have had an argument or nine with some dogs that didn't go well.
For the dogs, I take it.
You're correct, sir.
Hey, you think civilization spreading out has anything to do with that?
Well, you know what? Normally, I would say yes, but this region is very sparsely populated. But now that you mention it, I'm just recalling. There is dredging and some mining activities that could definitely be contributing to it.
Well, there you go. Anywhere we go, there we are.
Oh, so profoundly true. We have a very thought-provoking program for you this time out, which includes a discussion with two medical professionals about what causes a person to become a member of a cult. Back after a small reset.
Or did she?
You'll be shapelier, honestly.
It's finally flying out of the chute, friends, and heading to eyeballs near you. Grindhouse Resurrection Magazine, issue number 3. It's jam-packed with grainy goodness on all 76 pages. Like this, a splendid article by David Phillips on Peter Bogdanovich's 1968 debut film, Targets, starring Boris Karloff in what many consider to be his finest work, which is not bad considering that this film, at the beginning, didn't even have a script. As the story goes, producer Roger Corman was owed 2 days of shooting time from Karloff, and so told Bogdanovich, go make a movie, Peter. Read all the details in issue number 3 of Grindhouse Resurrection Magazine, available from 42ndStreetPete.net.
There's some seats on this ride you don't want to take. Got bolts?
TheFuseBoxShow.com.
Alrighty, friends. Oh, I wanted to mention also that during that gnome visit, I was taken up to, I think it's called Anvil Mountain. I hope that's right, if I'm remembering that right. And shown the abandoned radar station, which is perched up on the top of this area. Now, this was a reconnaissance station set up during the Cold War to monitor the then Soviet Union, which, by the way, is a mere 80 miles away from the coast of Nome. And think about that for a minute. That's about an hour and a half drive. Of course, you're not going to drive in the Bering Sea, but, you know, you get it. So it has this big fence all around this radar area. And what we found when we got up there was this fence had been trampled down by the aforementioned musk ox. So we were able to get right in there and take a peek around, and it was quite the experience.
So it was a big dish farm or what?
Yeah. So they were more rectangular in shape than the typical, disc-shaped things, but gigantic. I've got a pick or three that I've posted to the Fusebox website in the new news section that you can check out. Link in the show description, or just go to thefuseboxshow.com/new-news, and they will be pinned at the top of that page there.
Holy carp, is that you standing in the corner at the bottom there?
Yeah. That's just to give you a scale of these things.
Yeah, it looks like a gigantic waffle iron.
Yeah, it does it that, now that you mention it. So the title of this particular show, once again, comes from an old slang term for a person that repeats or follows another person's leading. Like a cult leader.
Or a former, now convicted president.
Precisely. The Maginoids have their fearless leader, and they blindly parrot out whatever he says, irrespective of the facts.
Or sanity.
You know, we were having a discussion several months back about this very topic here, and our partner in audio crime, Jeff Pollard, raised the question, what makes someone join a cult in the first place? Because clearly, not everyone is so inclined. Many are, though, and it's a valid question to ask. So I decided to do just that and ask a couple of professionals who have dealt with this issue in the past and have different medical disciplines, but arrive at some very interesting conclusions. And the first of these folks is Dr. Nupi Arora, and she has a general practice in Manchester, UK, with experience in safeguarding, domestic abuse, trauma-informed care, deprivation medicine, and addiction medicine therapy, which plays into this behavior pattern pretty significantly.
So this boils down to nurture, nature, genetics, societal norm, what you grow up with and around. And it can be generational. Things get passed down generation to generation. And including unhealthy habits, including core beliefs that become inherited as the norm. And until that's challenged and you break certain cycles, patterns of beliefs, you're going to retain it. And when you look at different personality types, I guess, and shall we say the more extreme in terms of negative behaviors, it tends to be a lack of. There's something that's missing. So you overcompensate with something else. And it's how I describe your whole self. It's mind, it's body, it's soul. It's all aligned. And it's truly understanding that alignment and actually what mechanisms are in place if there is a lack of something. Usually it's within the childhood when you're growing up. It boils down to healthy adult. To be a healthy adult, you need a healthy childhood. What does that mean? It's nurture, it's love, it's support, it's boundaries, it's room to grow, and it's also room to almost explore in a safe environment. But it's fueled by unconditional love. Unconditional, and that's the most important bit. Once you start putting conditions on as a child, you're kind of like a blank canvas. You don't know any different, but you will understand. All you need is that validation, be it good or bad. And when it's bad, you search for more. You start putting protective mechanisms in place. So, for example, a critical parent, a hypercritical parent, a child is going to respond, well, I want to seek approval. And it is then, how do I do that? How do I keep seeking approval? And it's people-pleasing. Perfectionism, unrelenting standards. That's where that schema comes from. But that's what you know. You don't know any different. And sometimes these traits will serve you so long until it kind of implodes in on you. I think it is a lack, but it's the protective mechanisms you put in place subconsciously to protect yourself. Because at the end of the day, you want to feel that love. You want reassurance. Yes, yes, I'm safe. I am loved and all of that. So then these protective mechanisms, this is what I learned through schema therapy, it forms layers, but they're not always the most healthiest. And these are the coping mechanisms that start forming. So for example, perfectionism in itself is almost the coping mechanism. If I do everything like this, keep my standards right up here, that means I'll keep striving because that means I'm good enough. And that means I'm loved, and that means I'm worthy. And that's just one of the schemas. That, I believe, these are the things that sort of start causing those sort of glitches almost. Why some people keep going down those glitchy road, I don't know. It's what they then go on to experience. Sometimes all you need is one person who is that supportive, healthy adult within your own vicinity, within your own environment. You can kind of shape from that. And it is, it's trauma. It's trauma-informed, it's trauma responses. And one person's trauma isn't somebody else's. It's how it affects that person. And it also is so subjective. It's what you experience. a lack of belief in self, a lack of belief in standing true to their own thoughts, beliefs, to challenge gently. You don't have to be all, nah, I don't agree with you, blah, blah, blah. No, but it's having the curiosity to challenge something, to actually think, really, does that make sense? Do I agree with that? Do I just follow the herd? It's independent thinking. And it's being true to yourself. That's where it all starts from. Not everybody is. In fact, majority of people are still half asleep. They're not awake. They're not aware. It's having the courage to follow your heart. Not what your mind says, not what the ego says, not what this preordained, what everybody else is saying and doing, because this is the way it should be. Well, who says? Challenge it. It doesn't have to be like that. You can create your own reality. You can change things around for yourself if you are in tune with your mind, your body, your soul needs. And it's perfectly possible. I'm living proof. I embody this. I practice this. I share this with my patients and from a health perspective setting. And it's instilling that faith. It goes back to me, for me, it goes back to courage, compassion for self, having that care, having that kindness towards self, and having the curiosity to challenge these things, because nobody else is going to do it for you. And that's the thing. You are in control of you, and you're that's it. You can't control anybody else. You're not responsible for anybody else's mood, happiness. It's down to that person. Everything influences, yes, but it's down to self. And it's having that very grounded sense of self, or that takes, that's not easy. It takes a lot of courage to go against the norm and break against convention and actually, no, you know what? I'm going to stand true to my values, my passions, my beliefs, and follow my path. And that is something that not everybody is either aware of, awake to, because it's not easy. It's actually really hard to stay in that lane. And actually, it's like, no, I'm not defined by anybody or anything. And that's the difference. Here are your options. Stop, pause, breathe, and ask yourself, how am I really, truly? Am I happy? Am I fulfilled, or do I think I'm happy? Am I chasing a rainbow here? Or am I truly living and being and breathing here and now, present in the moment? Because that's what it boils down to.
So a rather powerful conclusion there, and a holistic one at that, using the self as the rudder to guide one through these sorts of situations.
Well, you know, it's like we were saying the other day in that discussion. It comes down to your will. You have to be the one in charge of your thinking, not someone else. You're in charge of you.
As utterly uncomfortable as that may be sometimes. So I posed the exact same question to Dr. Thomas Doherty, and he had some interesting things to add to this. He's an award-winning professional psychologist practicing right here in Portland, Oregon, and who is also internationally recognized for his research on nature and mental health and the psychological impacts of global climate change. Here's Dr. Doherty.
Yeah, it's a neat question, and it's timely. I mean, I think there's a couple of parts to it. There's the person and who and what might be attracting them to a belief system. The term that we would use is an ideology, is sort of an emotionally charged set of ideas about people and their relationship with each other, or to relationship to the world. What draws people to certain ideologies? Because a cult needs an ideology of some sort. It needs some sort of belief system, or it wouldn't be a cult. Yeah, that's one part, like who's drawn to it, but then what in fact is a cult? I mean, as I was saying in our planning conversations, there's a famous psychologist named Robert J. Lifton, and he he has written some classic books over the years. He's still alive, and he's wrote through the late 20th century, and he wrote a lot of important books about society and about how people deal with power. He wrote books about the atomic fears in the Cold War, for example, and things like that. But he actually studied thought and mind control as part of sort of Chinese communism and things like that in the 60s and 70s. And then he wrote about that. Part of that research, he kind of gave us the knowledge of what cults are. And so it's interesting. You could find some of his work online and some... If you look into any program that helps people to recover from cults or try to get out of a cult mindset, then they'll often cite his work. Some of the aspects of a cult, there's sort of an environmental control part of any kind of cult-like system where communication and things are sort of controlled. Now, in the old days, you could imagine people going off somewhere out into the wilderness where you could easily control communication just because they're all isolated out there, you know, with a leader. In the modern world, it's interesting. We have these distributed kind of ways of controlling communication because we've got all this social media and things like that. So you can kind of create almost like a remote or an extended form of controlled, highly controlled communication. But there's that control of communication and a kind of an us and them kind of sense. And then there's some sort of, you know, cultivation of magical kind of ideas and magical thinking, usually from some sort of leader that, you know, really knows a person really well or in a special way or has supernatural abilities and things like that. And so, you know, people kind of buy into whatever the mythos of this kind of group is. And then it's really another one of his ideas is this idea of purity. You know, you have to really be pure and part of this group and this way of thinking and even confessing, you know, if you are not pure or confessing your sins. So it draws all kinds of psychological things out of people. And then, you know, everything becomes sacred and you can't question anything. And if you question things, that's threatening. And so anyone from the outside world is automatically threatened. So it builds this kind of in-group, and then there's special language and words and things like that that we all, like us and our cult, understand. So one way I think about it is, you know, when someone tells a lie and then they have to tell additional lies to cover the original lie, and then it become a big project to maintain some sort of subterfuge. And so if you can think of a cult as some sort of belief system that maybe not entirely true or sets itself outside of reality, then it takes a lot of work to maintain that. Now, who's drawn into this? You know, obviously people seeking meaning, some sort of meaning in their life, or people that are marginalized or disenfranchised or feel powerless, you know, people can buy into different kinds of cult-like movements because they, you know, activate their sense of esteem and power and control. And so we could see fascist movements and various things that come out during times of economic hardship when people are marginalized and don't have power. And unfortunately, with the state of the world right now, there's a lot of people that are economically marginalized. They feel left behind by technology and by the economy, because we have such great inequality. So we're ripe for people. If they feel left behind or out of the system, then they're seeking power in other ways. So I think that's what buys us into what gets people to buy into these things. And then I think there's a unique context right now that has never existed before in history, which is this, you know, mass communication has always been part of these kind of cult things. If you think about, like, you know, fascism in the 30s and things like that, rituals and mass communication. But now we have this, the social media and the internet and things, so people can connect and kind of create very, very, very narrow silos of information. So it really, I think it makes people vulnerable to being drawn into things, because sometimes you can't tell. Even with my work in climate change, there's a lot of climate misinformation that is particularly designed to look accurate and to look official, even when it's not. And if you don't know the difference, it's easy to get drawn in to things.
And those sources can be kind of masquerading, right? I mean,
yeah.
they could appear to be quite legitimate, but really aren't.
Yeah. And it's unfortunately good for business for social media companies because it just drives business. And a lot of these things are really primal messaging that really drives people's attention. And I found even myself, I've seen things in the news and originally I would think, oh, that makes sense. And then I'll realize, oh, that's not really true. Or that's a conspiracy theory. Sometimes it's hard to tell. You have to actually look into things.
I mean, critical thinking is sort of evaporating in our culture these days.
Yeah, it takes more work because there's a lack of trust. Like, we can't trust. And so, you know, I in my work with climate change, I distinguish between misinformation and disinformation. You know, disinformation is when someone's specifically trying to pull one over on you and really manipulate. And that takes a certain level of, you know, person or character. But misinformation is simply people, you know, putting around information that isn't true, but they don't realize it's not true. And that's a little more benign, but a lot of people can fall into that. And so that's something that we can work on that piece, which is that critical thinking. That's where the critical thinking comes in.
So the chap Dr. Dougherty was referring to, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, has written quite extensively on this topic of cults, and we've linked to some of his material as well. A really insightful chat there with Dr. Nupi Arora and Dr. Thomas Dougherty. I hope it was enlightening.
You know, I think some of those maganoids should check in with these two folks.
Certainly couldn't hurt. By the way, links to both Dr. Arora and Dr. Dougherty's websites are linked in the show description as well. And I produce a show for Dr. Dougherty called Climate Change and Happiness, and you can find that linked in there as well. It's a very informative program that deals with, the anxiety of climate change and how to deal with that. So, you should really check that out. That's really a very interesting... I seem to have a visitor. Hang on here, folks. Oh, Milo, how you doing, buddy?
Cults and stupid heads.
You've got a document? What? What kind of document?
A document.
It's what?
Yeah, a document. Yeah, flipping the bird.
A history of the bird. What is it? A history of a bird. So it says that before the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, the French, who evidently were anticipating a sure thing victory over the English, proposed to cut off the middle finger of all captured English soldiers.
Okay, this is getting really weird now, man.
What does this have to do with birds, Milo?
No.
Okay. So they, the French, would endeavor to remove the aforementioned middle finger, as it would be impossible to draw the renowned English longbow, and therefore they would be incapable of fighting in the future.
Well, this is getting more bat crap crazy by the minute.
hang on to your middle fingers. This famous English longbow that the French had a fear of, evidently, was made of the native English yew tree. Are you getting the sense of this now? And the act of drawing the longbow was known as plucking the yew, or pluck yew. You know, you guys are really easily amused. Much to the bewilderment of the French, the English won a major upset and began mocking the French by waving their middle fingers at the defeated French, saying, "See, we can still pluck you."
They've been plucked over.
You know, if you two don't behave, I'm going to turn this show right around. Hopeless. Going on here, apparently, over the decades, Americans have, of course, changed up the words. The pluck you is now, well, you know, and the words are often used in conjunction with the one finger salute. Another interesting anecdote is that the
pheasant feathers on the arrows used with the longbow is the reason that the symbolic gesture is known as giving the bird.
Well, that was plucking amazing.
See the birdie?
It just takes the whole show down, doesn't it really? I mean... And with that intellectually enriching discourse, thank you, Milo, for the memorable historical anecdote here.
Pluck you.
As I say, much thanks, friends, for joining us on this one. We shall call it a show, but not before thanking our contributors on this one, Dr. Noopy Aurora and Dr. Thomas Doherty, for shedding some light on the cult explosion we're currently living in. As I say, links to their respective sites are in the show description. Thanks as well to Mago Weston and Gregory Wilson for superior ID-ifications. Thanks as well to the intraterrestrial man of mystery, the prime consort of compression, Milk Canes, for technical assistance, and so forth and so on.
Another true slice. And folks, you can get a big round of applause from us by going to our Patreon page and signing up to become a member.
It's so simple, and you get free swag, early releases, and access to all the free cult deprogramming you could ever need.
That's patreon.com, The Fuse Box Show, to get it all going.
Thanks as well to our friends at Grindhouse Resurrection Magazine for the continued goodwill and deliciously grainy output. Issue number 4 coming soon. Find out more at 42ndStreetPete.net. Thanks, of course, to you, friends, for pushing play on this one. It's delightful to have you aboard.
Even though I think we're taken on water.
I have been your fully deprogrammed and ready for regrooving host, Mark Rowe, saying, until our next cartoon. I mean, that was a hell of an anecdote, Milo. Where did you find this thing?
Pollard.
Pollard found it.